Today on Maine Calling, a tour of women's history. Maine has long been fertile ground for the kind of strong women who make history, especially political figures, artists, and writers. You can read about them in history books, or in many cases, you can visit their homes. From the Frances Perkins Homestead to the Sarah Orne Jewett House in South Berwick, and several others, visitors can stand in the very rooms those women inhabited and imagine what they were thinking. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk about some of the notable women in Maine history and places that pay tribute to them, from historic homes to sculptures and plaques. We'll learn about efforts to recognize brave and creative souls that help shape our state and nation. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self, mainehealth.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is Women's History Month, and today we set out to highlight some of the remarkable women from Maine who have made history. There are many, from arts to politics, and there are also many houses, sites, and centers where visitors can learn more about these women. Well, joining me to talk about some of these places you can actually visit and some of the women whose stories they highlight, Libby Bischoff, professor of history at the University of Southern Maine. She is also an author and executive director of the Osher Map Library. And Earl Shuttleworth is with us, Maine's longtime state historian. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you visited one of these places and been moved by it? Is there somebody who you think everyone ought to know her name and they don't? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram. Well, you know, this is such an interesting conversation, and thank you both for joining us. We're going to talk about women whose names and stories are known. We're going to talk about women who are so well known that somebody has created some sort of monument to them, maybe a statue or preserved their home. But the reality, Libby, isn't it, that there have been many influential women throughout history, and I mean thousands of years, whose names we don't know. And maybe we ought to, but we don't. The simple fact of the matter is that history for a long time was not written about women.
Yeah, so much of doing women's history, not just here in Maine and the United States, but also across the world, is the work of recovery, and recovering the stories of everyday women in everyday lives. And one of the ways in which we do that is through sort of landscapes and archaeology, but also in text. So it is difficult in, you know, the 16th and 17th centuries to find stories or histories or records kept by women. So we really have to rely on sort of mentions of women in various texts that are produced, or also kind of life ways that come through to us through archaeology, and also through, like in Wabanaki communities, oral histories that are passed down since time immemorial that carry on the matriarchal traditions and the lineage of the various tribes as well. So we really have to do significant work to recover the history of women, much of which we'll talk about today.
Yeah. Earl Shuttleworth, so much of what we know, not just about women's history, but history in general, is often gleaned from journals and diaries. And one of the most famous diaries of a woman in I was going to say colonial, but pre-colonial America, or colonial America, is the diary of Martha Ballard, and she lived and worked right here in Maine as a midwife in Hollowell. Tell us a little bit about Martha Ballard, but also what we learned from her journal, not just about life in the U.S., but life in the wilderness of Maine at the time.
Yeah, the Martha Ballard Diary is owned by the Maine State Library, and it really is one of the very rare examples of a diary, an extensive, detailed diary kept day by day, year after year, by a woman who was very active in her community in the late 18th and early 19th century, as the Augusta Hollowell area was developing at that time. And it contains not only her record of her work as a midwife, but also many insights into what was going on in her world in the post-revolutionary period. Initially, it was transcribed and published in part in Nash's History of Augusta, and there is now a complete transcription of it available, published, and then also a notable book based upon her life and work.
So, you know, that Laurel Thatcher Ulrich wrote A Midwife's Tale, and now apparently there's a novel, Frozen River, that's based on that as well. So really giving us an insight to what it was like to, and I'm sure Martha Ballard was not trying to be famous when she kept her journal, and now she is. But Earl, I'm going to stay with you because we're talking about Martha Ballard was in the late 1700s and early 1800s. Another really well-known name who lived just a little bit later was Fly Rod Crosby. Tell us about her.
Oh, yes. Well, Fly Rod Crosby is a remarkable figure in Maine history, and her reputation, the interest in her just seems to continue to grow. In recent years, there was a wonderful wooden carved statue made of her, which is on display at the Inland Fishery and Wildlife Building. But also now there is a movement to actually create a more substantial bronze statue of her as well for the new IF&W complex that will be on the old Amhi complex in Augusta. Fly Rod Crosby was born in Franklin County. At an early age, she became very active in outdoor sports. Part of it, I think, was to overcome some health difficulties, tuberculosis in particular. She developed into being a notable sportswoman, not only in Maine, but across the country, particularly because of her extensive writings. And she wrote not only for Maine newspapers, but also for sportsmen's journals as well. She is the first Maine registered guide. She pioneered in various conservation issues involving hunting. She was also a great promoter of the sports life in Maine, in the Northeast.
All right, Libby, I'm going to turn to you. When we're in this era, when we've moved into the 1800s, are there any other names that you'd like to bring up and call attention to?
I mean, I think for me, in thinking about various women in the 19th century, is really looking at broader reform movements. You see so many women who are involved in founding societies, promoting temperance, promoting a little bit later on in the 19th century, women's suffrage, working hard on abolition, and then also working really hard on social reforms. I would just put a note in for Dorothea Dix, who's known very famously as both a prison reformer and a reformer for institutions of mental health, who was from Maine and really becomes famous for her work in Massachusetts and abroad in those social movements. So I really think of the 19th century of women coming into their own politically through these moral and social reform movements. So you have so many women's clubs and societies throughout the state of Maine, organized by town, sometimes by county, that are really bringing themselves more into the public eye on these issues of social reform, the legacies of which we can certainly see with us today. So I really think of the 19th century as this vast time of organizing for women in that way. And really, in like a separate gendered sphere, they were really encouraged to comment on moral movements, social reform, sort of born out of an era of Republican motherhood, responsible for educating their children and their families morally and socially. And they used these social reform movements to really propel themselves into public life and making many things better for us today.
And Libby, would you say that Maine was a particularly active place, a hotbed, if you will, for women who were pushing, whether it's suffrage or abolition or whatever the social reform reforms they were committed to were? I mean, was Maine one of those places that things were happening in the 1700, I mean, the 1800s, in the 19th century?
Yeah, you certainly see that the president of the National Women's Christian Temperance Union, Lillian Stevens, is working out of Portland, Maine. You see many figures come throughout Portland, throughout Augusta. The Abyssinian Meeting House in Portland, which is the third oldest free Black meeting house in the United States after Boston and Nantucket, is a real hotbed of social reform and having abolitionist speakers come through. Folks like Sojourner Truth and others. And so, yes, you have a strong tradition of social and moral reform movements going on in 19th century Maine that really have a distinct impact on the rest of the country. And as you can see, that culminate in, I know you're going to have folks talking later on about Harriet Beecher Stowe, but she really fits right into that as well.
Well, we do have her right now. Kathy Belcher is with us. She's an educator and guide at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House in Brunswick. Thanks so much for joining us, Kathy.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, I don't know if you were able to hear because you were calling in, but we've just been talking about the kind of commitment to social and moral reform and the abolitionist movement and Maine's role in that and the women of Maine in the 1800s. And of course, we had a very famous resident, Maine did, Brunswick did, and that's the house that you are a caretaker for. How and why was it that Harriet Beecher Stowe was in Maine?
Well, she had been living in Cincinnati, Ohio, because her father was the president of Lane Theological Seminary. She moved there with the family when she was 21, and there she met her future husband, Calvin Stowe, who was a professor of religion and a biblical scholar there. And they eventually got married and had six children. And in 1849, Calvin gets an invitation from Bowdoin College from Brunswick, offering him to fill a 2-year professorship in religion. And they knew of him because he graduated in 1824 from Bowdoin College as valedictorian of his class, and his subject was religion. And apparently a professor was on sabbatical, and he was hired. And it came at a very good time because they had just the year before lost their youngest child, Charlie, to the cholera epidemic, which put Harriet in an emotional tailspin. And some even say that she had a nervous breakdown from this. And so she needed a change of scenery. She was homesick for New England, where she grew up. And so they decide to accept this 2-year position. And Harriet comes ahead of Calvin. He's still finishing out the semester in Cincinnati, and she brings three of the children, and now she's pregnant with their seventh, and she comes out ahead of time to set up the house on Federal Street.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's how she got here. But an unexpected thing happened in that Calvin made it here in time to see the baby born, but then he gets an unexpected letter from Lane Theological Seminary saying that they have not been able to find a a replacement for him, and that his contract requires him to go back to Cincinnati and teach for that coming year. So Harriet's left in the house by herself with six children, one of them a newborn, and money was tight, as it always was for them, and she just started writing. I mean, she'd always been a good writer, and she had had many things published, but writing stories and starting a school in that house for not only her own children, but for professor children and neighbors' children, was how she supported herself for that year when he was away.
Unbelievable. I can't even imagine. Yeah. And she did write Uncle Tom's Cabin while living in Maine, correct?
She did, in that house. So she'd been wanting to write an anti-slavery novel for quite a long time, and her friends and her family had been urging her to do it. She just didn't know how to get started. And then in 1850, which is the year that she moved to Maine, and she was only here for 2 years, but in 1850, a few things happened. The Fugitive Slave Act was passed, and she started imagining that she could be walking down the streets of Brunswick and actually see bounty hunters, you know, looking for runaway slaves. And this just horrifies and appalls her. And she knows she has to do something. And then John Andrew Jackson, who was a runaway slave, shows up on her doorstep one night. And she and the children make a little bed for him in this little room off the kitchen, which is now my office. It's a very historic place. And he's there for the night, only one night. But they talk at great length. She inspects his back and sees all the scars from all the whippings he's gotten. He had come from South Carolina with it just barely making it with his life. He left a wife and child on the plantation, hoping someday to be reunited with them. But he was on his way to Canada, and he never did see his family again. But he had been told when he got as far as Portland that if he came through Brunswick, there would be many sympathetic people who would help him. And he ended up staying overnight at Harriet Beecher Stowe's house. And she gave him clean clothes and food and talked about his experiences, which helped her write the novel. And then she had a vision while she was in church one day at First Parish Church right here in Brunswick, where she saw the story playing out in front of her. She said it was so real that it looked like it was a play being put on in front of her, but it was all in her head, and it was the inspiration for the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, and she just went running back to the house and started writing.
Well, Kathy, we could talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe all day. So interesting, but very briefly, can the public visit her house?
Absolutely. We just reopened. I was hired back in 2016. The house never reopened after COVID, but until about a month ago. So we have very limited hours for the rest of this semester, but next year it'll be a lot more. You can come by Thursdays and Fridays from 12 to 3 or by appointment.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for calling in. Kathy Belcher with the Harriet Beecher Stowe House in Brunswick. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, a tour of women's history in Maine. We are discussing notable women of the past and where you can go in Maine to honor them or learn more about them. My guests, Earl Shuttleworth, who's Maine State historian, and Libby Bischoff, USM history professor who specializes in 19th century cultural history as well as Maine history. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about famous women from Maine, or do you have a really interesting fact you'd like to share? Send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Alyssa Sweet, who is the Southern Maine Site Manager with Historic New England, and that organization manages the Sarah Orne Jewett House. Thanks for calling in, Alyssa.
Hi, Jen. I'm excited to be here.
Well, obviously, Sarah Orne Jewett, another Maine writer who made a name for herself in the 1800s. Tell us about her. I've read Country of the Pointed Firs, but that wasn't the only thing she was known for, was it?
No, she actually wrote 8 novels and 13 short stories in collections. And Country of the Pointed Furs is her most popular and well-known. But she also wrote Deep Haven and A Country Doctor. And her most well-known short story is A White Heron as well. So she's pretty well-known.
Yeah, was it unusual for a woman at that time to achieve such widespread acclaim?
I think it probably was, especially coming from Maine. We don't hear about it too often. And in fact, Willa Cather describes Jewett as being one of her like big inspirations. And she said that along with Huckleberry Finn and The Scarlet Letter, Country of the Pointed Furs should be like an all-time American classic that everybody should read. And I think that's pretty sustainable.
Yeah, yeah. No, it really, you know, we did a program years ago on Country of the Pointed Furs, and so many people called in. Clearly resonates with so many people. Alyssa, tell us about the house and if and when you can visit it and what happens there.
Yeah, so the house is really cool. It was originally built in the 18th century, and then Sarah's family kind of took over it. Sarah actually was born in that house, but she didn't live there for much of her life. She spent a lot of time there, but she actually lived right across the street, which is where our visitor center is today. But when she was about 48 or so, she inherited the house from her grandparents. And you can see a lot of inspiration in her books that she took from that house, especially in Deep Haven. And if you come and visit with us today, you can actually sit at her writing desk and take a photo, and you can see her bedroom exactly as it was when she passed away in 1909. I really enjoy the house. If you look at it, you can definitely see there's some wealthy details. But I always say that when you walk into the house, you almost feel like Sarah's going to pop her head around the corner and be like, oh, good, you finally made it. Come sit down. It's a lovely house. We open June 5th. It's our first day. We are open in the summer through October, Thursdays through Sundays. And we do hourly tours from noon to 3.
Wow. And so, and also, Alyssa, there are events there and things like that. People even get married there, right?
They can get married there. Our biggest event of the year is our Pride Garden Party. Sarah and her partner, Annie, were what we can call a Boston marriage. And they were committed and had a very loving partnership and inspired each other in their works. So every year in June, we celebrate the two of them and the LGBTQ community and have a beautiful garden party out in the gardens. And there's music and cocktails and little appetizers. And we even have actresses come and portray Sarah and Annie and interact with the visitors as well. It's a really great and really special event.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Alyssa Sweet with the Sarah Orne Jewett House in South Berwick. And Libby, you wanted to talk a little bit more about Sarah Orne Jewett, right?
Just to tie some things together about the importance of women's visibility, even in the 19th and 20th century, you know, the caller had mentioned how Willa Cather was very inspired by Jewett. Jewett was very inspired by Harriet Beecher Stowe. Uncle Tom's Cabin was a really important book for her. And just these women writing and being published in these major national publications made it possible for other women to do the same, as Jewett is getting early stories published in The Atlantic and other places in Boston. So there is this long tradition of women mentoring women, women authors, women artists, as they move through this work. And the more in which this is made visible through the houses, through these visits, it's just really important to note these connections over time and where you can find out more about these women, both in the built environments and also buried deep in the archives.
And Earl, like Martha Ballard's diary, we learn a lot about what life was like in that part of Maine through her writing as well, Sarah Orne Jewett's, because her father was a doctor, correct? And she rode along with him on visits.
Yes, that's correct. And I think that the great strength and the great enduring interest in her work is that she was so skillful in recreating the whole sort of ambiance of New England rural life in the 19th century. And indeed, she was inspired by those early trips with her father. But also, she just was imbued with the life around her. I just would add, too, that The Jewett House is preserved by Historic New England, and not far, also in South Berwick, is the Hamilton House, which actually Jewett was very instrumental in preserving, and it's also owned by Historic New England, well worth visiting at the same time that you visit the Jewett House, and it also is the place where the Tory Lover, which is one of Jewett's novels, is set as well.
Well, we're in the 1800s, and I know that there are a couple other women that you want to highlight, Earl, from this period. One of them is Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's sister. Why is she so important to you?
Well, Anne Longfellow Pierce is not nearly as well known as a woman historical figure in Maine, but I like to always remind people about her. She was the younger sister of the poet. She grew up in the Wadsworth Longfellow House, which is, of course, right on Congress Street in Portland and available thanks to the Maine Historical Society. She married very early in life to one of her brothers, both classmates, George Washington Pierce. And sadly, he died in the early 1830s, and she then returned to the house in Portland and lived there for the rest of her long life. She lived until 1901. Her parents died in the mid-19th century, and she inherited the house and became responsible for it, basically lived there largely on her own for over 50 years. And beginning in the 1850s, her brother began to become not only nationally, but internationally famous for his poetry. And people began to visit Portland and knock on her door and want to see the house where Longfellow grew up. And so she realized, I think, early on how important the house was to people. And in the 1880s, as an older woman, she was offered $26,000 for the property. Someone wanted to tear it down and build a commercial building because commercial buildings had been built all around the house on Congress Street. But she refused, and instead, she wrote in her will that the house would be left to the Maine Historical Society as a tribute to her family and as a museum. And it became in 1901, at the time of her death, the first historic house museum in Maine. So I think we have Anne's to thank for the commitment that she made to saving that family heritage, which had a much broader meaning to so many people.
And another contemporary of hers, a little bit younger, is Margaret Jane Muzzy Sweat. I'm reading these last names. Lots of Muzzies around, lots of Sweats
right.
around. But this is another author.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, she was born a little bit later than Anne Longfellow Pierce. She was born in 1823, and she was born in a great three-story federal house that her father, John Muzzy, who was a very successful merchant and landowner, owned at Danforth and High Streets in Portland. It no longer stands. She became a very successful literary figure in the mid to late 19th century, particularly for reviewing books. And she also wrote poetry and she wrote novels. In fact, she's credited with writing the first lesbian novel in American literature called Ethel's Live Life. She married Lorenzo de Medici Sweat, who was a lawyer and a politician. And in 1880, they bought the McClellan House, which was another one of these great federal period houses, now part of the Portland Museum of Art at Spring and High Streets, built in 1800, 1801, very similar to the house that she'd grown up in with her parents. And she cared very deeply about preservation and the arts. And so when she passed away in 1908, she left the house to the Portland Society of Art. That was then what the Portland Museum of Art is now called. She also at the same time left a considerable fortune to build the Lorenzo de' Medici Sweat Gallery behind the house, which was the first of the sections of the art museum to be built. She was very active not only in the arts and literature, but she also for many years, for decades, was Maine's representative to the board of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, which was the organization that saved and to this day preserves George Washington's home, Mount Vernon.
Wow. Well, thank you for letting us know about a couple women that I don't think are household words for most. We're going to leapfrog a little bit now. We're going to go to the 20th century. And joining us is Ashley Toll, Ashley Toll, right?
Yes, Toll.
Okay, sorry. She's Director of Women and Gender Studies and Assistant Professor in the Department of History at the University of Southern Maine. And you are calling to talk about Frances Perkins, who only recently is sort of getting the attention she deserves. But tell us about Frances Perkins and tell us about the house that people can visit.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, where to begin with Frances Perkins? I have to say, I was born in Maine, and embarrassingly, growing up, I didn't know anything about Frances Perkins. It wasn't until I went into graduate school and started studying history that I learned about her and really the monumental legacy that she has left. So Frances Perkins was the Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. She is actually the longest serving Secretary of Labor. And she served for the entire length of FDR's presidency. And she's the first woman to hold a cabinet position in the United States. So just that in and of itself is huge. But what she was able to accomplish while she was Secretary of Labor is really profound. It's things that Americans today really take for granted, or maybe not so much right now during the political climate, but things like Social Security. Frances Perkins was the one that got that accomplished for Americans. She was also instrumental in creating a minimum wage, for creating the opportunity for labor unions to actually collectively bargain and have that opportunity to do so. You know, if you enjoy your weekends, you have Frances Perkins to thank for that.
For the 40-hour work week. That's right.
Exactly. So she is really instrumental in a lot of the things that American workers really value today. She is the woman behind all of those.
Right. And my understanding, Ashley, is even though her family for multiple generations was from Maine, she did not grow up in Maine because of her father's job, but came back every single year to stay in the house that is now the homestead that people can visit, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So her family, they considered what is now the Frances Perkins Center, the homestead, they considered that their home. But Frances was actually born in Massachusetts. In Worcester. So she wasn't born in Maine, but really when she thinks about what her home is, it is that homestead in Newcastle, Maine. And she would come back every summer to really relax. Like, this was the only time that she would have to relax and really restore herself to get back to Washington and do all the important work that she did.
All right. And, you know, we could, again, go on and on. We've done whole Maine calling programs on Frances Perkins, but I do appreciate you calling in today for that little highlight. Ashley Toll is with the Frances Perkins Center, and she's also with USM's Department of History. Thanks so much for calling in. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're moving through Maine history and learning about some of the impressive women who have lived and work here. Also learning about places and sites where visitors can honor these women. Joining me, state historian Earl Shuttleworth and USM history professor Libby Bischoff. You can share your comments and questions by a very brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. An email here from Jefferson. I'm the archivist at the Maine Women's Writers Collection at the University of New England's Portland campus. We're a small literary archive that is open to the public, and we love to welcome professional historians and academics, but especially anyone who's interested in researching Maine's rich literary history. If you love Sarah Orne Jewett, come check out her Letters with Annie Fields. If you love diaries, come read through our collection by everyday Maine women that span hundreds of years. And if you want to find out who the snow baby is, come explore Marie Perry Papers. Let's see here. Another email. This is a fun one. This is from Melissa. This is, you'll know why this is fun. Your sound engineers... That's Sam, who's running the audio board right now. Your sound engineer's great-great-grandmother solely ran the Winter Harbor Agency from 1912 to 1945. She was likely the only woman running an insurance agency at the time and grew the business that still exists today. Her name was Ruby Tracy. And then from Charlene, another email. Early 20th century UMaine entomologist. First entomologist in Maine. They would not pay her for that work, so she had to also teach English to get paid. Her home was called Brayside, and it is on the Maine 10 most endangered properties. And let's see, in the note I have here, I don't have her name, but I'm going to try to see if I can grab that really quickly. Let's see here. Edith Patch. Edith Patch is an entomologist. Yeah, you know that, Earl. You're nodding.
Yes. No. You're correct. It's Edith Patch, and her house is adjacent to the university. Yes.
Wonderful. Well, calling in now is Chris O'Brien. He is director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library. Chris, thank you so much for calling in.
Happy to be here.
Well, we know Margaret Chase Smith was the first woman to serve in both the House and Senate, and we also know about her famous speech, but let's just pretend that there are people listening today. Maybe there are people who moved here from somewhere else or don't know. Tell us about the conscience speech.
So in 1950, new to the United States Senate, Margaret Chase Smith gave a speech which, without mentioning Joe McCarthy by name, denounced his tactics more than anything. It's in the midst of a brief speech that it's turned out to be incredibly influential in American politics. It's cited regularly as a statement of conscience, the name of the speech. It's also a willingness to stand up and speak to the chaos that McCarthy was creating. For some reason, it remains a timeless speech.
And tell us about the Margaret Chase Smith Library. What is that location? What is your location used for? What can visitors find there?
Well, so I'm glad you asked. We're here in Skowhegan, and the library is actually attached to her home. So it is a library, a museum, and an exhibition space. And just to make things loop back together, currently we have a visiting exhibition from the Francis Perkins homestead. Margaret Chase Smith and Francis Perkins maintained a relationship over many years. We're friendly with each other. We have some correspondence between them that we've added to their exhibit. So here in our exhibition space, we have a small but lovely exhibit that people are welcome to come visit. We also have a museum which is the chronicle of her life, amazing in all sorts of ways. I think her parents knew that she would be who she was because they saved things like her baby booties, her bonnet, her high school diploma. So we track her way through her political life, through the Declaration of Conscience speech, and for the many years that followed that. And then we have a research archive, 350,000 some pieces of correspondence, all of her speeches, all of her public statements, the 95 academic hoods that she received for honorary doctorates and honorary master's degrees, a very, very lovely collection that we're happy to have people come visit. One of the things that we do, and we're headed into that season right now, is we welcome school children, K-12, to come through and tour. And I think we have 2 days available in May that are not currently booked. I suspect by the time I finish this sentence, that will no longer be true. But hundreds and hundreds of students come visit us every year, and we have programs available for them and welcome folks to come in and visit.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling in. Chris is calling. Chris O'Brien is calling from the Margaret Chase Smith Library. So as we're talking, Libby, about places to visit, and we've talked about homes and libraries, there are also just some nice things. You know, at the top of Mount Batty in Camden, we learn about Edna St. Vincent Millay. And there are also a couple trails in Cape Elizabeth, the statue of Joan Benoit, who is, you know, still alive, so not really technically part of our conversation today. But, you know, there are a lot of nice things in the state of Maine. And there are a couple history trails, right? There's a Portland Women's History Trail. And then, so you can tell us about that. And also, if you could tell us about the Suffrage Trail.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think a great way to get out and really understand some women's history in the built environment and this active recovery work that's going on is to follow some of these trails. So certainly the next time you find yourself atop of Mount Batty, please do look for the plaque honoring Edna St. Vincent Millay, who was born in Rockland in 1892, and they quote from her poem Renaissance. Up there, you can also find a statue of her outside of the Camden Public Library. And actually, her birth house in Rockland is now a nonprofit and home to a writer's residency program and a host of creative events. So people can go and visit that now. And that's a very new addition to the house landscape. The Portland Women's History Trail is decades of work by my former colleague Eileen Egan, Polly Kaufman, Pat Finn, and others, and countless generations of USM students who have researched the everyday lives of women laborers throughout history, people who lived in particular houses, religious organizations, women, schools, all sorts of the history of everyday life and the hidden work of women. You can find that trail online and easily walk it. It's organized by neighborhoods, so you can have a few excellent walks with that. But one of Maine's newer women's history trails is actually kind of put in place for the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, which happened right during COVID in 2020. And so the William Pomeroy Foundation reached out to all sorts of states, and every state could apply to put up various plaques and markers honoring women working for the right to vote. So I'll just mention a couple of the ones in Maine that you can seek out. One, we haven't talked about the many contributions of Franco-American women to Maine's history. So you can go see at the former office of Le Messager on 223 Lisbon Street, a newly installed plaque to Camille Lessard Bissonnette, who is a really prominent suffragist who had moved from Quebec to Lewiston in the early 1900s when she was 21 and became very active for women's votes on both sides of the border at a time when that was a very difficult stance to take. We got the vote here in Maine in 1920. Her sisters in Quebec didn't get it until about 1940. There's some other lovely markers in Farmington for Isabel Greenwood, who organized the Farmington Equal Suffrage League. The Bangor Public Library honors the Black matriarchs of Bangor, who are really forming women's improvement societies and clubs and working for suffrage there. And I really also wanted to mention the site on Indian Island, which honors Lucy Nicolar Pula, who was the first Maine Wabanaki person, she's Penobscot, to cast a vote, because we assume that voting, you know, came into being in 1920, but that wasn't true of all the people living and residing in Maine. Maine did not extend the first vote to Indigenous populations until 1954, and Lucy Pula cast the first vote. That's why she's honored with the plaque on Indian Island for that. And full enfranchisement for our Wabanaki populations didn't come in Maine until 1967, which is one of the last states in the country. So these trails, these plaques are really important to understanding history that's otherwise hidden and calling out the incredible work of everyday women who might otherwise be lost to history, save in their own families and own communities.
You mentioned Lucy Pula, which makes me think we haven't mentioned, and there are going to be dozens of these, but we haven't mentioned Molly Spotted Elk yet.
Molly Spotted Elk, a very prominent Penobscot performer, traveled all over the world, dancer and singer, and culture keeper in many ways. And I think the increasing visibility of all of these folks who reside in the state of Maine, of all of the cultural work of women especially, is so important, because a lot of women get into the public eye, not just through politics early on, but certainly through their art, through their performances, through carrying on cultural heritage and the making of basketry. And so much incredible work has been done by the Maine Basket Makers Alliance and others to keep that work moving forward at this time. So the more the better that is coming out about that, and the more the better that is being shared in communities and in schools, thanks to LD-291 and the work of Donna Loring, who was a Penobscot representative to the legislature for many years and the first women police chief in the state of Maine. This history is being taught in schools because of that work and that visibility.
Earl, I know that you want to talk about a woman that, you know, we've talked about lots of authors, but there was a Maine woman actually nominated for a Nobel Prize in author in 1965. Tell us about her.
Yes, this would be Marguerite Yasnow. This is who you're referring to,
yes.
Right? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Marguerite Yasnow was born in Europe, but she chose to live a good part of her life on Mount Desert Island, particularly in Northeast Harbor, and she lived in a wonderful little house called Le Petit Plaisance. And after her death, a foundation was set up to preserve the house. She's particularly known as a writer for her book, Memories of Hadrian. And she is the first woman to be accepted into the French Academy.
Wow.
And we have her home available to visit during the summer months on Mount Desert in Northeast Harbor.
Wonderful. And Craig wants to remind us, this is an email, don't forget the Flyrod Crosby Trail in Madrid and Rangeley, please. So that's relatively new, the trail. We'll go to Larry, who's calling from Mount Vernon. Larry, we're tight on time. If you could be quick, that'd be great.
I'll try to be quick. There's something I wanted to add about Frances Perkins. My father was an Austrian Jew, and in 1938, looking back, I always wondered why it was so easy for him to come to the States while many of his relatives were murdered by the Nazis. And it turns out that Frances Perkins in the early 30s was the only member of the cabinet saying we need to open up immigration, you know, the quotas for Jews trying to get out of Germany and Austria. And even the Secretary of Treasury, who was Jewish, opposed her. And as Secretary of Labor, she was able somehow to, you know, my dad's sister had married an American, and she allowed family members of American citizens to bypass the quotas that prior to her, you know, they had to go through. And so my dad was able to come here right away, you know, while a lot of his, you know, friends and relatives had a hard time or didn't make it. So I just sort of wanted to add that about Frances Perkins.
Larry, thank you so much for calling in. Yeah, Frances Perkins, we could talk about her for days. I really appreciate it, you calling in and adding that as well. We have a little email here. Let's see, an email from Dorcas. The Ride of Her Life by Elizabeth Letts is the amazing story of the 63-year-old Maine farmer Annie Wilkins, who rode her horse across the U.S. in 1954. Okay, we have a minute and a half left, Libby, and we haven't even mentioned Rachel Carson.
You can't get everyone on a day like today, and that visibility for working towards all women is everyone's responsibility. But for sure, people should understand how important Maine was to Rachel Carson and her writing of Silent Spring. Southport Island was really her refuge and sanctuary in the world, and where she did so much of her own work, not just her writing, but exploring in the natural world. So there's a small plaque where her ashes were scattered by her friends and loved ones upon her death in Southport at the site of her house, but also much more open to the public. Folks can go and walk the Rachel Carson National Wildlife Refuge in Wells, Maine, and keep her at top of mind.
Well, thank you. Earl, we have 25 seconds. Is there anybody else you'd like to throw in there?
Well, I'm just going to add one more footnote to Frances Perkins. Recently, I learned that early in FDR's administration, in those first months, she was the one who recommended to him that there should be an art program as part of the New Deal. And he agreed to that. And of course, what resulted was a huge body of work by American artists in the 1930s and early 40s.
And influential is an understatement. Well, thank you both for joining us today. That's Earl Shuttleworth, Maine's longtime state historian, Libby Bischoff, professor of history at the University of Southern Maine, and executive director of the Osher Map Library. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy, Maine Calling, produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the automotive gurus are back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.